Every year on the first weekend of February, hundreds of people come to Palo, a remote northeast Minnesota community so tiny, it's nothing but a former school building in a clearing in the forest. Kids ride plastic sleds down a hill and out onto the frozen lake. Others ride a traditional Finnish wooden sled, whipped round and round at the end of a long pole. This is the Finnish Sliding Festival, or Laskiainen. Inside the old gymnasium, a crowd listens to the Finnish national anthem. People put their hands on their hearts. The oldest ones know the words. These are typical middle-class Minnesotans, with cars and pickups and snowmobiles waiting outside in the parking lot. Their Finnish immigrant ancestors were landless peasants, unskilled laborers, or impoverished tenant farmers. People like Andy Johnson's family, who left Finland in 1906 when he was not quite 7 years old. He remembered the trip in an interview tape recorded when he was in his 80s.
Finland was a poor country. Grandpa was a tenant farmer. There was no future there for father and the rest of us. We came in a wooden ship from Finland to England and took a Cunard liner over across the Atlantic.
The Johnson family left Finland at a time when the population had grown dramatically and there was not enough farmland to go around. There had been famines in the late 1800s. Then, in 1899, the Tsar of Russia decreed that Finnish men could be drafted into the Russian army, and tens of thousands of Finns left for America. Many of them came to northeastern Minnesota. Like the Johnson family, they were seeking jobs in the newly opened iron mines there, or hoping for the chance to homestead a farm of their own, to be rich and free in America.
Mother picked me up when we entered the harbor of New York, because everybody crowded to the railing to see the Statue of Liberty, and I couldn't see it. I was that much shorter. So she picked me up and held me.
But the Johnsons came at a time when the best land had already been homesteaded. As they went west, they passed through country that had been settled by immigrants who got there generations before the Finns.
We took the train from New York, and we were on that train day and night. I don't know how many days and how many nights, and there didn't seem to be any end to it. I remember I was looking out of the window, I was watching the scenery, you know, as it went by, and there was a beautiful place, a beautiful farm, you know. And I told Ma, I said, well, why don't we stop here? But no, we kept on coming.
The family got off the train at Aurora, a raw new town where the air was filled with red dust blowing off the iron ore stockpiled from the mines. Whatever they may have expected, it was not a place of boundless opportunity. They arrived with little money and speaking no English. Andy Johnson's father joined the immigrant workforce, people from Finland, Italy, Serbia, Croatia, and many other countries in the Iron Range mines. The main shaft at the Tower Sudan mine, north of Aurora, drops down half a mile through solid rock. The mine is a state park now, and visitors can still ride the old elevator cars that lowered the miners into the darkness. The air is damp. Water drips from the ceiling of the car and runs down the window in tiny rivers of dissolved red dust. Finally, the car slows and stops. Tunnels lead off into the blackness. Wilfred Leinonen is a guide at the mine. His great-grandfather worked here.
My grandfather come in 1900, and he wrote back to his wife in Finland that in America there's gold under every rock, because he got paid by the ton. And so every time he picked up a rock and put it in the car, that's money. And the more of them he put in there, the more money he made. And he's making more money than he ever made before in his life.
But the promise that drew landless peasants like Leinonen's grandfather across the ocean often faded over time. The miners worked 10-hour shifts, 6 days a week, moving the heavy ore almost entirely by hand, in a darkness broken only by the flickering lights of the candles on their helmets. There were frequent accidents. Miners had to pay for their own equipment and supplies, and sometimes, after all their backbreaking labor, ended up owing the company money. In 1907, the immigrant workforce in the Iron Range mines went on strike. Many of their leaders were Finns. "We are striking for wages, but principally for an eight-hour day," a young Finnish immigrant testified before the governor of Minnesota. "If we lose this strike, Minnesota will no longer be a place where it will be possible for Finns to live." The miners did lose the strike. The mining company hired strikebreakers and armed guards to defend them. Workers who had struck were fired and blacklisted. The number of Finns in the mines dropped by more than half. Andy Johnson's father was among the workers who kept their jobs, but he and other Finns had won a reputation with company officials. Andy Johnson remembered it years later.
"This friend of my father's came from the old country, and he wanted me to go to one of the mines to ask for a job. So I went with him to Hudson Mine out of Aurora. So the clerk at the office says, 'What nationality is he?' Well, that surprised me. I was about 10 years old. And I said, 'He's a Finn.' He said, 'We don't hire any Finlanders.' He says, 'They're no good.' I didn't know what to say. So I turned around and walked out, and John, the guy I was with, he was asking me, 'Mitä se sano? You know, what did he say? I couldn't get the words out of me. Down the road a ways, then I told him."
Mining company officials described Finns as a surly, troublesome lot, and complained about their socialist tendencies. Many Finns were indeed socialists, a movement that had made its way into Finland from neighboring Russia. When the Tsar cracked down on leftists all across the Russian Empire, many Finnish socialist leaders had to flee Finland. They came to America, many of them to Finnish mining communities. Appalled at the conditions they found there, they helped lead the strikes.
I must have been about 9 years old when there was that great strike. The whole range went on strike.
In 1916, mine workers on the Iron Range went on strike a second time. Lily Marie Mackey Isaacson, whose father was a miner, remembers.
"Workers of the world unite. That's what I remember about it. And I remember singing Marseillaise, you know. And my father insisted that we go and march in the parade. And it was a long parade, because with all the workers, naturally, going down the main street of Bawabik. It was in the summertime. And then our neighbor had a pop factory. He had gone with his horse and wagon to the mines to sell pop. And they shot him. Guards or whatever you call them. They killed him."
The mining companies soon put down the strike, and again, workers who had struck were blacklisted. Many Finnish miners moved to the lumber camps of northern Minnesota, but conditions there weren't much better than they were in the mines. That winter, timber workers went on strike and lost. Finns blacklisted from the mines and the lumber camps had one other opportunity, the chance to homestead 160 acres of some of the worst farmland in America. Out of a job and out of money, Andy Johnson's family moved to a homestead.
So we came out here in the wilderness. We had to carry everything on our back for the last 7 miles because you couldn't drive a horse through in the summertime because the swamps were too soft. And the father had carried a gun in one hand and an axe in another. He had a pack sack full of grub and one kid on top of the pack sack. And the rest of us followed. We carried what we could.
Much of the land the settlers farmed was called stump farm land, land the timber companies had logged over and left, and no one but the Finns seemed to want it. It was said that Finnish was the only language the stumps understood. Winter temperatures in the area often dropped to 40 or 50 degrees below zero. Esther Norha's family homesteaded near what became the Finnish farming community of Imbaris. Her pregnant mother, her father, and her older sister walked out to their homestead site in November of 1909.
I still think it was the neighbors who helped, because they were all Finnish people, and they looked after each other. There was that neighborliness and caring. That's what I think brought them through that first winter.
The growing season was too short for almost any crop but potatoes, Families like the Norhas and the Johnsons hunted and fished and worked odd jobs. Many men worked seasonal jobs for mines or lumber camps when they could, while the women and children took care of the livestock. Struggling to make their way in a new country, they survived by sticking together in tight-knit immigrant communities. Finnish immigrants held dances and put on plays in what were called Finn Halls. There were Finn Halls all across northeast Minnesota. Al Recko grew up in the tiny town of Crosby in a house right next door to the Finn Hall.
From the time, earliest times I can remember, I remember going to the dances. I learned to dance with my mother. Everyone was on the floor. As soon as the music started, it was elbow-to-elbow people.
The Finn Halls were a place not just for socializing, but for political activities. The Iron Range mining strikes were organized in the Finn Halls. The halls were just one part of the immigrant society Finns built for themselves. There were Finnish language newspapers like the socialist Tuomas, Finnish for working man, and a region-wide system of cooperative stores serving Finnish immigrants. Walter Harju, a leader in the Finnish cooperative movement, remembers.
When they began to organize these, you know, John Nummivuori had a little cubbyhole in the TMS building, you know, where he had some samples of coffee and things of that kind, and he would make arrangements with the wholesale to get discounts. One of the problems was to get commodities to these people. They couldn't even get them from the stores, you know, they were boycotted. They had a difficulty in getting materials, and very much of the difficulty came from not being able to get credit. Any credit, you know, and when you go on a stump farm, you haven't got available money all the time, and consequently, they needed these cooperatives.
The Finnish cooperative movement grew into one of the largest retail cooperatives in the country, lasting into the 1960s when it finally gave way to big chain stores. Although it was eventually split by political differences, in its early years the movement was unabashedly left-wing, as a glance at the goods lining the shelves showed.
We had the Red Star, the Blue Star, and the Yellow Star, and all of them had a sickle and hammer. The Central Cooperative Exchange truck had a great big sickle and hammer on its side when it drove around Duluth and Superior. And this was the time when the cooperatives were the most successful, because it created unity. It wasn't only to get a can of beans.
Tulkaa tytöt yötulille, valukaa valkeille.
Ai luli, ai luli, valukaa valkeille.
Finnish women played a major role in organizing the co-op movement, the newspapers, and the Finn Halls. Many Finnish immigrant women had come to America on their own to work in boarding houses or as domestic servants. Their independence and self-reliance were nurtured back home in Finland. Women there were the first in the world to win full voting rights and citizenship in 1906, 14 years before American women won the right to vote. In this country, Finnish immigrant women were active in the suffrage movement. In Duluth, they tried to organize a union of domestic workers and published a daily radical feminist newspaper. Not all Finns were radicals. Some were deeply religious and socially conservative, the so-called white Finns. But it was the radical or red Finns who drew the most attention. Finnish immigrants were the first in the nation to found a foreign language group of the Socialist Party. Finntown in Virginia had a three-story brick building known as the Socialist Opera. By one estimate, a third of the Finns in one section of the Iron Range in 1913 were socialists. In the 1930s, 40% of the total membership of the American Communist Party nationwide came from one small immigrant group, the Finns. Finns often faced hostility and discrimination. Their radical politics were part of the reason, but there were others too. The Finns were known as clannish. They had a strange, difficult language. Their beloved sauna was seen as an outlandish, barbaric custom. Finns had a reputation not just as troublemakers, but as hard drinkers and knife fighters. An American newspaper writer once questioned whether Finns possessed souls. the word Finlander became a derisive term of both ethnic and racial prejudice. Cultural historian Marianne Wargelin.
One time, and I'm a fourth generation Finnish American, one time I said to my father, "Well, you know, us Finlanders." And my dad said, "Marianne, you can't say that." And I said, "Why?" He said, "That's a racist remark. That's a put down of the worst variety."
Racial prejudice against Finns sprang from a belief that they were related to Mongolians. Some 19th century scientists cited the Finns' exotic language, which is unrelated to other European languages, as evidence Finns were racially unrelated to Europeans. It was said they descended from a tribe that migrated from Mongolia. At a time when federal law barred all immigration from Asia, a federal immigration committee investigated the Finns' racial background, examining them for such physical characteristics as small eyes, high cheekbones, round heads, or stocky stature. Historian Marianne Wargelin.
After the 1907 strike, one of the ways that they tried to isolate the Finns was to make them be seen as Asian. There was an Asian Exclusion Act, and if they could get the Finns defined as Asians, then they could get the Finns kicked out of the U.S.
In 1908, federal authorities tried to use the law to deny citizenship to 16 Finnish men. A Duluth judge ruled in favor of the Finns. In keeping with the racist tenor of the times, he wrote that Finns had white skins and thus could not be denied citizenship. But the case's echoes lingered for years. Will Sandstrom's family moved from northern Minnesota to Duluth during World War II when he was about 9 years old.
And we lived in what was then called Finntown in Duluth. Then there were other parts of town where the Norwegians lived and the Swedes lived. And I remember my name was Sandstrom and this other fellow's name was Carlson. And we were white, blonde could be. And the Swedes, because they knew our parents, grandparents were from Finland, and they'd go and put their, you know, fingers by their eyes, make slanty eyes and say, "Hey, China Swedes, hey, China Swedes."
China Swede was one term, roundhead was another. There were also more subtle forms of discrimination. Sometimes Finns were looked down on simply because they were poor. Lily Marie Mackey Isaacson, the little girl who marched in the mining strike parade in Buwabik, remembers how her teacher humiliated her for having chapped, work-worn hands.
I was sitting in the last seat in the row, and she would come by me, and she'd take my hands, and she'd say, "You dirty hands, you know." And she said, "Tell your mother to put cold cream on them." And I said, "We don't have cold cream." "Well, tell her to put Vaseline." I said, "We don't even have Vaseline." And then she put a sign on my back, "This girl has dirty hands," and I had to go into the other room. And I stood in the hall and cried. Some of those hurts, getting Americanized, huh?
Kaliva Hall, a quaint old world brick building in what was once Virginia's Finntown, sits at the edge of a played out open pit iron mine. In the basement of the old Finn Hall, older men and women are having coffee and pulla, Finnish cardamom bread. The women sing a folk song about the lakes and inlets of Finland. They cherish their grandmother's old country recipes. The hardships and poverty their grandmothers endured are a distant memory. Finnish Americans are now comfortably settled in the middle class. Unions ended the exploitation of mine workers. The futile attempt to turn cut-over timberland into flourishing farm fields was abandoned decades ago as Finns found better opportunities elsewhere. Some say Minnesota's progressive political tradition is due in part to the radical politics of the Finns, but the Finnish radical movement is long gone, along with the deep economic injustices that spurred it in the first place. The story of the Finnish immigrants on Minnesota's Iron Range is unique in time and place, but its themes, exploitation and discrimination, and the fight for acceptance by a wider society are universal. If the past is any guide, the Vietnamese and Hmong and Somalis and others who are trying to find a new home here can take some hope from the experience of the Finns. For the rest of us, it's a reminder we are a nation of immigrants with separate pasts and a common future.
Finland Was a Poor Country was written and produced by Minnesota Public Radio's Mary Lozier and Dan Olson, edited by Ewan Kerr, mixed by Alan Strickland. Special thanks to the Minnesota Historical Society, the University of Minnesota's Immigration History Research Center, and the Iron Range Research Center. Thank you.